This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry here with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
We're recording just after the close, Friday, April 1st. Sam, there was the World Cup draw was this morning. It was kind of a spectacle, as most of these types of events are. But at the end of the day, we got all 32 teams or 32 spots were up. The big news for the U.S. here is that we're playing England on Black Friday, so the day after Thanksgiving. So it'll probably be there's already talk that this will be the most watched soccer game in in U.S. history.
All right. Is it going to take place during office hours? If so, we should be in the office. I don't know when these things...
The games are like 2 a.m. Pacific, 5 a.m. Pacific, 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. So hopefully it's not that 2 a.m. Pacific time.
Yeah.
You would think that they would maybe adjust it a little bit for given who the participants are to maximize the TV revenue. But
well, I know I need to watch it, you know, with you so I can actually understand what's going on and make comments about all the flopping.
Yeah, well, we'll watch Neymar in Brazil and flop. He can flop around some more, and everyone in America can hate him.
Yeah, he's the guy with the commercial, right, where he just flopped over the Taco Bell from the pitch, is it called, or the field, or whatever.
The pitch, yeah, yep.
The pitch all the way across the highway, the freeway, in the Taco Bell. But
I think Brazil is one of the favorites, so we'll see a lot of Neymar.
All right.
Let's get into where are we? It is April 1st. We just finished the first quarter last night, and some movement today. So let's get into it.
All right. So happy April Fools to your dad. I know it's his favorite holiday, as we were talking about earlier and last year. But let's kick it off with the S&P 500. So here we are today on April 1st. So give a little bit of the highlights over the first quarter as well, since we just wrapped that up yesterday. But on the week to date, the S&P 500 just pulled out a win, up 6 basis points on a end of day type of rally that we just had in the last, let's say, 30 minutes or so of today's trading day. So that put it up with a positive print for the week. But the S&P 500 is still down 4.6%. For that first quarter, again, that's through yesterday. So looking at the quarter view here, the energy sector was the best performer, up over 39%. It's kind of in line with some of the things that we've been talking about in the across the energy complex in commodity land. But in terms of wrapping it up with equities here, it looks like communication services is bringing down the other end of the spectrum with a negative 11% return for the first quarter of 2022. Looking across at some of the other equity indices, the thing that pops out most here is I see that the value index, the Russell 1000 value, pretty much trounced the Russell 1000 growth index there by over 8 percentage points, with growth down over 9% for the first quarter of 2022. So a very poor showing from the growth sector within that context there.
I think that could qualify as a trouncing.
Yeah, it does. That's pretty bad. I mean, relative to every other index that we look at, it looks like the Russell 2000 was the second worst. That was down 7.5%, and the Russell 1000 was down 5%. So outside of the Russell 1000 value, it looks like if you had your monies in something around the S&P 500 index, related type of investment, you might have fared second place in that realm. Looking over at fixed income, the two-year treasury ended 2021 with a yield of 73 basis points. 3 months later, it closed the first quarter with a yield of 2.34%. And we're even 11 basis points higher, I see, from that today at the close at 4.1, April 1st, with a yield of 2.45%. So the two-year treasury yield has been steadily marching upwards for the better part of the year here. And then looking at the 10-year yield at quarter end matched the two-year yield. So for those that are keeping score, the twos tens curve was exactly flat at zero as of 3/31/2022. Today, we have a bit of an inversion. It just tipped negative and lasted through the close. And we have an inverted twos ten spread right now at negative 8 basis points. So Jeff, you and I, we've been talking for the past few weeks, how we were saying that the twos tens is a good signal for being on recession watch once it gets inside of positive 50 basis points. We spent the better part of the last 2 weeks right around 20 to 25 basis points. And then finally, on this Friday, as of the close, it looks like we are now inverted at negative 8 basis points.
Yeah, it was a pretty big move too. And it wasn't a kind of a trickle down. It was very large moves we had during the week on a couple of days. And so we went from 20 to 12 to 2, and then we kind of been hovering around that 2-3, and then went negative went negative today. So we'll see how long that persists.
Yeah. So again, for those keeping score, the 2-year treasury yield as of the time of this recording today on Friday, April 1st, is 2.45. As I scan across the curve, the 10-year yield is below that at 2.38. And then the long bond is even below that at 2.43%. So both below with yields below that of the two-year treasury. So what does that all mean to the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. bond aggregate? The bond aggregate actually pulled out a positive for the week, up 75 basis points on the week, but it's still down 5.9% on the quarter. And you know, looking at the Bloomberg here, we saw that you have to go back to the first quarter of 1980 or maybe the third quarter of 1980 for a worse period during on the Bloomberg aggregate there. So definitely a milestone here. It's the third worst quarter in that history of that index there. So the weakness was shared for this quarter to date, negative performance across all of the aggregate's constituents. On the quarter, the investment grade corporate index was down nearly 8%. It was down 7.7%, and treasuries were down 5.6%, and agency mortgage-backed securities were down just about 5% on the quarter. So there's no shelter within the ag, but outside of the ag, when we take a look at below investment grade corporate credit, you didn't have any shelter there either, with the high yield down about 4.8%, and bank loans were down just a little bit, 10 basis points for the quarter. So that was a relative win there if you're into the floating rate market there via the bank loan index. In terms of commodities ended the week down as well, down 4.6%, but it was up nearly 26% for the first quarter of 2022. So the big winner on the first quarter as well as year to date is the broad basket of commodities. But here, when we take a look within, it looks like the energy sector led the way. Most of the constituents within the energy sector were up over 50%. Looks like unleaded gasoline futures were up 40%, so a bit of an oddball there. And then WTI crude oil was only up a measly 33% on the quarter. But the other four commodities within the energy complex were up over 50%. But as listeners may be aware of now, that the WTI has had kind of a little bit of whipsaw on the week around news that the administration plans to release. The numbers I saw was around 180 million barrels over the course of the next several months. A lot of pundits there say that it probably means 6 months. The insiders are saying that. So that works out to be roughly a million barrels per day that could be released. We were talking a little bit on the desk about this. It seems like it may be a little bit more bluster than substance, since the current, there's questions around the whether or not the current infrastructure can handle that, not only the output on a daily basis, but also over the course of several months. I'm not sure if it's really maintained or designed to handle that the output over the course of, let's say, 6 months or so. And then also the initial indication is that the release could be for sour crude, which is typically is what we export over to Asia, and that's a different type of crude than we typically process here in the US. So we've seen a little bit of the impact already in terms of the price. Looking at how WTI has journeyed over the course of the year, as of the end of 2021, it was at $75 a barrel. It got as high as $130 in early March on the back of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And then today, it looks like it closed the day and settled just at about $99.50 a barrel. So definitely a little bit of a roller coaster ride there for those that are participating in that market.
Sam, I can't believe that you would imply that a politician would choose bluster over facts.
Yeah, it's definitely a good headline thing to make people feel a little bit better, like the administration is going to be doing something. But like everything else, as you suggest, Jeff, I guess we just have to wait and see what the actual results will be.
Yeah, I mean, the next step is we'll start seeing some bluster about price controls, and you know, that's if inflation stays up at you know, these high levels, we'll see some price control talk, and you know, that doesn't usually work out very well either.
Yeah. And, you know, on this topic, for those investors that might have missed, or sorry, those listeners who might have missed this episode, or for those that want to go back and refresh this discussion around the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, you can look back to episode 41, which was recorded on November 12th, 2021, where Jeff and I devote an entire topic of the week to the acronym of SPR. So, you know, hopefully people find that useful. And then finally, moving over to, let's see here, what's my pick for next? Let's look at Bitcoin. Bitcoin basically flat over the first quarter. Looks like it closed out today somewhere around four, or at the time of recording, it's somewhere around 45,800 Bitcoin. It started out the year somewhere around 46,000. So just down about 1% over the first quarter of 2022.
Yeah, so that's just noise for Bitcoin.
Yeah. I was actually surprised that you know, it wasn't moving, but then I realized that we're already over past the first quarter as I refreshed the sheet, so that's why it wasn't moving. But let's see where it closed right now. So yeah, it's actually up 5 basis points. Right now at the time of the recording relative to where it stood at the end of year end. So it made that up pretty easily. Who knows? It probably went up 5% on the year to date, and then now it's back down to 5 basis points. So that's where we are. That's where we stand as of April 1st, but then also with that review of the first quarter in terms of investable markets. With that, Jeff, do you want to kick us off on what happened this past week in macro land?
Yeah, I'm sure, Sam. On Tuesday, we did get the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller 20-City Index. That surprise to the upside was up 19.10% year over year. It's expected to come in, I think, at like 18.6. So it was slightly higher than expectations. The narrative out there is that consumers are scrambling to get into the housing market before the impact of higher mortgage rates hits them. So that's the narrative. That's why prices were up. We'll continue to keep an eye on this and see how it moves as rates are higher. I think I saw mortgage rates are up to about 5% level now, so up another, as you would expect, given the move in the kind of the 10-year of about 25 basis points or so on the week. Tuesday, we also got the JOLTS job openings. That number was actually higher than expectations of 11 million. It came in at 11.266. So again, Jay Powell seems to be keeping an eye on this number. So that's something to keep in, to think about and keep an eye on. So that number was a little bit higher than expectations. Thursday, we also got personal income. That number came in as expected at 50 basis points. Spending dropped. It was also expected to come in at 50 basis points, dropped to 0.2%. The good news, though, is that the spending last month was revised up by 0.5%. So as we say, net-net was actually higher than expectations. Thursday, we also got the PCE core deflator. That number was slightly below expectations at 5.4%, was expected to come in at 5.5. So that's, I guess from that side of things, it's a little bit better than, a little bit better. Inflation maybe isn't continuing the acceleration to the upside. If we look at the monthly numbers, that came in at 0.4% as expected. But if you kind of dig into it even more, it was a 0.35 before the round. So maybe a little bit softer than expectations. And we do have a 0.4, 0.6, and a 0.6 rolling off the next 3 months. And so, just a reminder to focus on that monthly number, because that's the 0.4, the 0.6, and the 0.6 are known. So we really want to see the trajectory of those monthly numbers. This morning, we did get the ISM manufacturing for March. That number came in a little bit below expectations, at 57.1. Up from, or expected from, was 59 last month, came at 57.1, still expansionary though. And then the big numbers were today on Pizza Friday. I forgot to have pizza for lunch, so maybe I'm gonna see if I can get some pizza for dinner. Non-farm payroll number came in at 431,000. That was expected to be 490,000, so came in 59,000 below that expectations. But similar to the personal spending numbers, the two-month revisions were up 95,000. So the labor market remains strong according to this metric. We're now only about 1.6 million total jobs below the February 2020 peak. Similarly, the unemployment rate, the U3, fell more than expected to 3.6 from 3.8. It was expected to fall to 3.7, so it fell by 20 basis points there. The underemployment rate fell also to 6.9%. That's the lowest underemployment rate since January 2020. So again, more confirmation that the labor market's strong, and the labor force participation rate also came in as expected at 62.4. So again, I think some part of the move we saw on the 2-year today, as the curve flattened a lot, it was a strong labor market, and really the labor market not being or being strong enough to kind of withstand some pretty big Fed rate hikes now. And I think if I pull up the warp function here, we're now looking at, looks like over 25 basis point rate hikes now priced in before the end of the year. So an increase of 2.15% in terms of the Fed funds rate before the end of the year. So the market's continuing to price in a very aggressive Fed, and the strong labor market has done nothing to think that the Fed is going to slow down their pace of rate hikes.
Yeah, that kind of the double whammy that we received this week of strong labor, strong jobs, as you mentioned, but then also persistently high inflation as well. I mean, within there, you mentioned the PCEs, but then even within the ISM data, we saw that the prices paid data point came in well above expectations, as well as previous print as well. So more fuel, more ammunition, however you want it, for Jay Powell and his crew to proceed as they are indicating in their forward guidance.
That's right. Well, I mean, I think that makes sense. Also, let's move that to the topic of the week. And from this one, we got a question from Charles in France. So we can, I remember we had a question from a listener in Australia, probably in around the fall of last year. So now we can add France and Australia to our list of overseas countries where people are listening.
Are those two countries in the World Cup?
They are. So Charles should be, he did make a comment that he liked us talking about what he called real football. So, as us Americans call it, soccer. France is one of the best teams in the world. So they got one of the high seeds, and they're in the group D. Where they play Denmark, Tunisia, and then they get one of the playoff teams, which is likely to be Peru. You never know with these things, but France looking pretty good there to advance out of their group.
Now, when Charles says real football, how's football? Is it spelled F-U-T-B-O-L there?
That would be the that would be the Espanol way to say it.
Ah, okay. Okay. So that's the real way then. All right.
All right. So back to the topic or the question, Charles said, don't you think comparing this current cycle to other cycles due to the balance sheet expansion since the financial crisis and COVID impact on the treasury curve, that we should maybe pay more attention to the real yield curve as opposed to the nominal curve, which is telling us something very different today? And does the real yield curve contain value add? He also notes that since the beginning of the year, the real yield curve is upward sloping and it has steepened this year, and that the Fed should be very comfortable hiking rates aggressively and significantly, given that that shape of the real yield curve compared to what many investors think due to the recession warning given by the nominal yield curve. And so, you know, we did hit up Gregory Whitley or Whiteley. I always call him Whitley since that's what he's been called for years and years and years, even though his name is Whiteley. Gregory Whiteley, we did talk to him about, and he's our portfolio manager, head of our government trading team, our government portfolio team, on his ideas and his thoughts around this question there from Charles. So Sam, why don't you kick us off on what Greg was talking to us about?
Yeah. So I think somewhere embedded within Charles's question is almost the notion of asking, is this time different for the nominal yield curve inversion as a signal for recession, given the balance sheet expansion as well as the COVID impact on the treasury curve. So Charles and other listeners, we've tackled, Jeff and I, the nominal yield curve inversion as a signal in a previous podcast. So I think the short answer here is that we don't think it's going to be different this time around, but the long answer can be found on that previous episode. If you dig back, it was fairly recent. I want to say it's within just about a month ago or so that we last recorded that.
Well, you have it written here as February 11th, episode 52.
All right. So episode 52, February 11th is where we got it there. But in terms of the question on the importance of real yields this time around, so what Whitley said was he was telling us that the real yield curve is mostly outside of the Fed's control, specifically when it comes to changes in the policy rate, which is the overnight Fed funds target rate, and that part of the curve, that policy rate has the most impact on the shorter end of the nominal curve, and basically the market does the rest. So, in talking to us, Greg used the 2-year point of the curve as the example here, with market expectations of Fed policy really driving that 2-year nominal rate higher, as we indicated earlier in this episode, as that has been pricing in the path of Fed policy. When we take a look at the 2-year real yield in comparison, that has moved less because market-based inflation expectations, as can be seen through break-even rates. Those have moved higher, and with that move, that has effectively suppressed a commensurate move higher relative to nominals when we're looking at real yields here. So, I did write down this the statement that Greg made, where he basically said that break-evens or inflation expectations are controlling real yields. They're effectively suppressing it as the market prices in the nominal yield, as well as market-based inflation expectations are keeping the real yields lower. Although, albeit they have moved up for most of the curve, except for the 1-year point of the real yield curve that has dropped lower as inflation expectations have increased, particularly in that part of the tenor. In terms of Charles's second question, with the Fed's comfort being very comfortable about hiking rates more aggressively, Greg took his cues from the Powell's March FOMC presser. And in there, a journalist actually asked, let me see here, I wrote it down, how concerned are you that further inflation surprises will offset the effects of recent policy firming by leading real rates to stay at levels that do not actually provide much restraint to the economy? So Greg's interpretation Paul's answer was that basically it's stuff that we've been talking about, Jeff, for some time now, that at least since November of last year, that the Fed is afraid of inflation and intends to use monetary policy aggressively in order to fight it. That was really the culmination of the Powell pivot this time around back in November or December of last year. On the rate side, in terms of the tools, the rate hikes should have basically lifted front-end rates, as we saw most meaningfully in the two-year part of the curve. And that could serve as a headwind in theory for inflation, while at the same time, it should have an upward lift effect on real yields. On the asset side, as far as the balance sheet, we've talked in the past about the Fed's sizable footprint in that relatively less liquid TIPS market. Now that quantitative easing is over and quantitative tightening, I'm just going to call it QT. QT is on the deck. Real yields should also begin to push higher as the Fed exits or reduces its footprint there. Finally, Greg also noted that the U.S. Treasury could likely also have an impact on real yields there as well, as they have already reduced their nominal issuance of treasuries, but not their TIPS issuance. So there's also talk that TIPS issuance may actually go higher over the course of the year. And with that increased supply, we could see further upwards pressure on real yields there. And I think overall, Greg was saying that he expects, you know, as some of the Fed's footprint moves out of the balance sheet there, that he does see the real yield curve kind of catching up, if you will, to what the nominal yield curve is implying at this point. But right now, again, it seems that the inflation expectations are really over what are controlling real yields, and to a lesser extent, perhaps the footprint of the Fed there.
Yeah, it was something that when he did talk about the changing of the auction sizes was something that, you know, not being intimately involved in these types of markets was something I didn't really think about or see. So that was always good. That's why we always wanted to talk to him, since he's always in depth in these markets. And then he also made an interesting comment about, real yields, and that the people who buy TIPS are, you know, usually if you believe the efficient market hypothesis, everything's priced in, but then really the people who are buying TIPS are people who are worried about inflation, right? So they're maybe they might take a lower real yield just to be protected from that higher inflation event. And so those are the people who are actually the buyers of it. So maybe you have a little bit of a skew there in terms of your real yields, just given the if you kind of take out the Fed's footprint. Just the natural other buyers of those types of inflation protected securities.
Yeah, that's right. And one thing I also did is I was taking a look at the real yield curve for clues in terms of its potential usefulness as a signal for recession. And, you know, as Greg suggests, the real yield curve does flatten and does invert at times with regards to being a signal for recession there, but there was less historical data to really analyze. But just that quick look that I took, it seems like real yield curve inversions seem to be an inferior recession signal. That's probably why people don't really look at it. Then it's relative to its nominal yield counterpart on the curve there. What I saw there is a lot more false positives. There are longer lead times typically between the inversion and the subsequent recession, measured in years more often than not. But there was the one or two stray cases where it's actually the other way around, where the recession begins and then the signal inverts, if you can call it a signal, the curve inverts months after the recession begins. So in terms of looking at it from that standpoint, it doesn't seem to be as useful. But, you know, I think Charles does have a point there in, you know, trying to piece out, you know, some of the interactions that participants are having on the real yield market, and we're more likely to hear this chatter come up in the future. So hopefully some of this information that we got by way of Greg Whitley will prove useful for Charles and other listeners. I know it was helped, like you said, you know, Burry, it was useful for me to always hear Gregory's insights as well.
Yeah, I thought it was good to talk to him. And certainly if twos tens stays inverted, What do we say? Like, you know, 5 days, 10 days, you know, 5 business days, 10 business days, whatever the number you want to use as your cutoff. As more we get closer and closer to those cutoff days, we're going to see more and more papers out there kind of talking about why this time is different. And, you know, we're of the belief that this time is never different. And so you can take it for what it's worth in terms of whether you think it's a good recession indicator. But if you think it's not, you're not going to be able to, you know, disprove that it's not a good recession indicator for, you know, another couple of years, because the lag time or the lead time, I guess, on that signal is, you know, anywhere up to, you know, 18 to 24 months, or I think in 2020, what was it, 3 months, but I don't think it was projecting a COVID recession last time, but certainly, you know, we do have some time to see whether, if it stays inverted, whether the signal continues to work.
Yeah. And just like all the other signals that we look here at on the team, we just, it's hard to base, to have any type of conviction just based on one signal as well, right? So we take a look at them in our toolkit and see, look for corroboration amongst the other indicators that we look at as well.
That's right. So we were on watch, and I think I keep on struggling, and I haven't really thought about what else we would call it, but maybe we put it under a recession magnifying glass instead of just watching at it, glancing at it. We got to dig in a little bit deeper.
Hopefully you don't have to get the microscope out soon.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So with that, Charles, thank you for the question. Hopefully you found it useful. I know we're months away yet, but good luck in the World Cup.
Yeah, we are. I had the ticker up here. As of right now, we're 233 days, 13 hours and 20 minutes. From the kickoff of the first game.
Well, I'm not too excited, so I'll be able to deal with that time probably better than you.
Well, the first game's at 2 a.m. Pacific time, so yeah, it's going to be a little rough.
All right, we'll try to keep you up until then, and yeah, as well. So, all right, with that, let's shift gears into the things to keep an eye on. It looks like a pretty light week for next week. On Tuesday, we have the ISM services data come up for the month of March, and the expectation is that it moves up from 56.5 to 58.6. If that does prove to be the case, where it beats the previous months, then that would mark the 22nd consecutive month of expansion. Or actually, I said that wrong. If it is above the 50s, that would make it in the 50s. It would make the 22nd consecutive month of expansion.
Seems likely
given that number and the expectation and what we had previously. So we'll keep an eye on that for everyone. And then on Wednesday, we should have the FOMC minutes released for the meeting that took place on March 16th. That always has a lot of little nuggets in there, and maybe we can glean some information in terms of hints on quantitative tightening. I did that on purpose. You see how I made it through?
Yes.
I slowed it down, or QT. And
that's why I wrote balance sheet normalization.
Yeah, normalization or QT. Hopefully we get some hints there, some informational nuggets out of that.
I think Powell said in the press conference that we'd be able to glean something from it. So we'll see how much they put in there for kind of wide consumption. And there hasn't been as much talk as I would have expected in front of the minutes release on terms of, you know, pace and size of the QT. So, you know, it might surprise the markets a little bit, or, you know, maybe we get some Fed speak, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or right, you know, right before the minutes release, kind of priming the market for how fast they're going to go.
Yeah, it has been pretty quiet actually from Fedland. So I do see when I pull this up on the Eco on Bloomberg, it looks like Williams, Brainard are all scheduled to speak next week. And those are big members within the FOMC. We also have Harker and, Bullard seems to be making the rounds all over yeah, the place. So he's speaking next week. And then we have Bostic and Mathis as well. So maybe someone out there will give us a little bit more off-script remarks.
Yep, hopefully. Well, I think that wraps it up for this week again, Sam. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in to Monday Morning Minutes. Please subscribe if you haven't already. And don't forget, you can pick up the latest episode each Monday before the bell. We should be available at all of your favorite podcast platforms. And if we're not, just shoot us a line. You can hit us up on email at minutes@doubleline.com, or you can hit us up on the Twitter at DLine Minutes if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for us. And we did have it's kind of one of those things when it rains, it pours thing. We went through a little bit of a drought on listener questions for a while, and then all of a sudden we got almost a handful here. So we will be taking those in time as we get through. And then just judging based on some of these emails, we may need to break a few of those up, but we can figure that out when we get to it next week, Jeff.
Yep. And yeah, keep those questions coming, because if you have the question, I'm sure someone else also has the question.
That's right.
You can find more information about DoubleLine at our website, DoubleLine.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/DoubleLineCapital. And we got a new Sherman show this week with Dr. Funk about Chile, Chile did not make the World Cup. So that's pretty bad for them. And I know that you asked me before you did the part of the Sherman show, you asked me how that was going. And it was, I think they were playing Brazil that day. So it wasn't.
Yeah, it sounds rough then.
Yeah, it's rough. Make sure to follow Sam and Jeff Sherman on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great week.
Thanks, everyone. And good luck out there.
This audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by the listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person or a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk. Securities mentioned are not a recommendation or solicitation to buy or sell. These securities were chosen based on their active overweights within the representative portfolio to explain portfolio positioning and the forward-looking view of the market that drives such positioning. For the preceding year, beginning August 24th, 2021, a list of all positions is available by request at media@doubleline.com. Equities may decline in value due to both real and perceived general market, economic, and industry conditions.